Okay, so Mickey's Monkey is out in 67, mm-hmm. and then we go to your next 45, mm-hmm. Which is also the same year, and Blow to My Soul and She's Gotta Be True. How does this 45 come about?
That's Doug's tune. That's a great one. Go ahead, Doug.
Well, this I'm not sure where these are songs written by David Stewart Sandler. And his affiliation, I'm not sure whether it was Peter May.
Peter May, yeah.
Was it?
Yeah. He was acting as the arranger that night, to my recollection.
Yeah,
Peter really took an involvement. This was going to be a big hit, you know, so.
Well, he wanted it to be, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And now this David Stewart Sandler was an incredible, he was very good at writing music and lyrics.
He actually did play the piano on that.
He did
though?
Play the piano part on the Blow to My Soul.
I know there wasn't room for me, but I was real close to him on the bass, and I started doing it, and then he started simulating that on the piano, and we play together on that, and, you know, look over at him, we try and stay together, and Peter's directing over here, and yeah. So the musical track, the beginnings of it, started out with the drums, that grand piano, and the bass, I believe.
Yep.
Yeah.
Had you heard these songs prior to going to the studio?
No, they bushwhacked us. We walked in and said, here's your next song, pretty much.
Peter Huntington May told you that?
Yeah.
Okay. Was Dale Menton involved with this 45 at all? Or?
I don't think he was.
I can't remember if he was. I don't believe he was much involved in
okay,
this.
Okay, no. So you go to the studio, and how do you learn the song? Does David Sandler play it for you?
Right, on the grand piano, and then just like we would work out a song, you throw in drums and you throw in bass and you start playing together with that grand piano. And at that point, he was probably singing it and Doug was learning it. And it was decided somehow that, and thank God, that Doug would sing that song because Doug's a fantastic singer.
So Doug ends up doing the lead vocals, and there's background vocals on this as well?
I believe there is.
Ken and there again, Ken... Tom and myself, probably. They might have thrown Doug in on a high part again on another track if they could spare it out of four.
That was, I don't know how we did it, but if we can, too bad we don't have time to listen to that for just a second. But
yeah.
There's actually, we had a string quartet from the University of Minnesota come.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
To play the strings on the bridge. Although there weren't synthesizers in those days. You couldn't do it on keyboards. You had to get real players.
Was it all scored out?
Yeah. David Sandler could write, mm-hmm. you know, to what us at that time looked like chutes and ladders.
Oh, and Ken, and that, other than Mickey's Monkey, you know, Ken played the trumpet on that and did fine. So,
yeah.
That sounds all right.
Yeah. But it was just the amazing thing of getting all that sound, and there's a lot of it there on that song on four tracks.
Mm-hmm. And same thing with She's Got to Be True, also another David Sandler song, correct?
Right. So we had to learn two songs that night.
Now, I think David sings on the She's Got to Be True, doesn't he?
I think.
Isn't that his voice on there?
I think you and Ken might be.
Oh, see, I don't know.
On the lead vocals?
Yeah.
You can tell it's been 40-some years. So.
So on She's Got to Be True, who's singing the lead vocals?
I believe it was Ken and myself.
Okay.
And we tried to do, of course, once again, we're trying to do the sync thing. And
okay.
All that was new.
And Justin Sandler would have been a secondary vocal on this? He would.
Boy, I seriously doubt it, but we'll go back and check on that.
You don't think he was on there at all?
No.
Okay. All right. That's good enough for
me. He did do the talking part of Blow to My Soul. Okay, look what you did to me now. That's him. He's a good talker.
Okay, so in the middle of Blow to My Soul, there's kind of a talking part.
Right, that's him.
Yeah. Okay, let me tell you what you did to me now.
That's David Sandler.
That's David. Yep.
Okay, so you did these two songs in one night.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like how many hours roughly? You remember?
Boy, it's new. Hard to even think of hours.
We can't remember who sang
McDonald's. That was more how we measured time.
Exactly.
So did you have to go back for the mixing, or did Peter May do all that?
No, I think that night was it, in my recollection.
You mixed the whole thing?
Yeah.
We got all the tracks done, and the mixing they did on
They added the violins after.
Oh, okay. You weren't there when the violins were put on.
Just, I was there started, when the violins were. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I was. And of course, Ken had to be part of it.
Oh, sure.
And Ken and I hung out a lot. We actually lived at the same place in those days.
Okay, your second 45 comes out, which is Blow to My Soul. And what happens with this 45? Any airplay?
Oh, yeah.
That got airplay also.
WDGY and KDWB again?
Mm-hmm. And points maybe further than Mickey's Monkey. As a result of that one, it's on an old radio ad that we played down in Lincoln, Nebraska with the Steel Roving for that song. So
got airplay in Lincoln.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. About the time a Little Picture Playhouse and Phil from the Steel Roving.
Phil Bergall.
Yeah, he has the number down and it sticks in his mind. It was the biggest audience that they'd played for or we played for number-wise. But
so they knew your band down in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Oh, right. Yeah. Right. Huh. Yeah,
so we made it all the way from Fargo down to Lincoln, Nebraska.
I don't know if it was Lincoln. I think it was Lincoln. We had to stop and do an interview at a radio station.
Yeah.
Or was that the Grand Forks or the?
Well, we did one up there too. Yeah.
And again, this is totally all new to us. Here we are, 19-year-old. Well, I was 19 at the time.
Yeah, I think Tom was still a junior in 67. In 67, I would have been 16 years old until.
We used to have to
New
pick
Year's
Tom
Eve.
Up at Capitol View Junior High
right.
School
he
to go
to
jobs.
He had to skip his last class and then head out for Lincoln, Nebraska.
Tom Poling was in junior high.
At that time, yeah.
At the time.
Yeah, he was a year younger than me, and I was kind of ahead a year in school. So,
who did you play with in Fargo?
Well, the Steel Roving, and I recall after the job, we went to some
No, he's talking
some
Fargo.
Party. Yeah, Fargo.
Okay.
Fargo, and that... To my recollection, somebody had Sergeant Pepper's that night, and they had it going after the job. So,
but was this the same job with Freddie Cannon?
Yeah.
So, in other words, you were the backup band.
Yeah, we were still the geek band, you know, the Steel Roving. They had a cool name. They had the look. They had the with
well,
they it.
They had were, Hey Joe at the time.
Right, right. Hey Joe was big, and... Mm-hmm. And Peter looked at us and said, well, you guys can be the backup for Freddie then. But we played with him, and then we went on and played our own set later that night.
Freddie with a lot of, woo!
Yep.
Tallahassee Lassie, woo!
Freddie Boom Boom Cannon.
Right.
Was there anybody keeping track of record sales on these two Falcon 45s? This is also on Peter Huntington May's label, mm-hmm. Falcon.
Right.
Number 71. Was anybody... Do you know how many copies he sold at all, or was there distribution? Or
no, but Ken always cut out the newspaper and has copies of what it did in the platter poll. That seemed to be the thing we went by, but it didn't give numbers. It just said that, you know, this one was number 5 in sales at the record stores this week. So,
was the band able to get more money for gigs having 245s on the air?
Yeah. I think we went from no pay to about $15 a week at some weeks.
Did you have a band vehicle?
Oh, yeah. Sure. Right after Mickey's Monkey, our dad co-signed for a brand new Chevy van. So,
what year was it?
That was a 67, and we took that down to Lincoln. It was still on the break-in, and we'd played Iowa State University and woke up a little late, so... Ken did one of his usual, let's see how fast this van can go to get us to Lincoln, make the job. So we did that routine.
Were you able to fit all your band equipment in the vehicle?
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And five and of us?
Some. Yep.
What kind of equipment is the band hauling around at this point?
What was the PA at that point?
Bruce PA, and then Fender amps, probably.
Yeah.
There's pictures. There's evidence. That time
at some point, I had a Sears Silvertone amp with 610s in it, but I'm not sure when I changed that into a Fender.
Yeah,
I know I ended up getting a Fender Showman, I think.
And what kind of keyboard are you playing, Doug?
This was a Farfisa combo.
Okay, and Jim, what kind of bass?
Well, I'm going to say I still had right before Blow to My Soul. I picked up, Tom liked to go in guitar stores, and he bought a Guild, so I had to get a Guild. And I was still using a pick. Ken said, get rid of that pick. Every good bass player plays with their fingers. But I still used a pick, and that's what I did on Blow to My Soul to get that galloping thing.
Yep.
And a guy, I had forgotten all about this, but Guild actually had plastic-coated strings at that point, so they looked like the old toy ukulele with the plastic strings, but sounded pretty darn good. Yeah, so I had... Tom and I were playing Guilds at that point.
At some point here, the band starts recording Trip Through Hell, the album. When does that start?
Probably with that next 45.
That would be Smooth as Silk?
Mm-hmm. That would have been our next 45. And it was the first time we kind of switched from what we would have considered, I guess, classic danceable... How would you say it?
Popular music?
Commercial music into something that we just said, let's do this. And Smooth as Silk was a whole different
Well, they write it well nowadays. They say something clicked in Ken's mind. He wrote the tune, and where his ideas come from, we still don't know. But
it's a more progressive type of rock and roll. Were you guys influenced by some of the psychedelic bands?
Definitely.
Oh yeah,
definitely.
We were.
What psychedelic bands had you seen or heard on the radio that you liked?
At that time, I liked Vanilla Fudge a lot.
Yeah, they were good. Vanilla Fudge. Strawberry Alarm Clock. A lot of people make the connection that has a vibe of that sort.
So it starts out with a gong. Not a lot of songs start with a gong.
No. Huh. No, which we lost in a snowstorm up in Hibbing. But.
And Ken also is the writer of the B-side, Doctor of Philosophy.
Yeah. No, that really takes it far away from anything we had recorded before. So,
different time measures and...
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's more experimental
mm-hmm.
than the typical...
Three-chord progression, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, is there a change in the band lineup for this record?
No, not on... Did we get a new drummer for Smooth as Silk?
Well, Rick's on there, sure. So Rick Johnson came in, and he was on Smooth as Silk.
Okay.
That's one of his favorites.
So Paul Samuels is no longer in the band?
Yeah, we had played over at New City Opera House, and Paul had always wanted to go to art school, and... That was his reason for leaving the band.
Where did you find Rick Johnson?
Well, Rick went to the same high school as Ken and I, and Rick had actually recorded Ken's first recording with him, so those guys hung around a lot, and we used to work together out caddy and kitchen duty out at the White Bear Yacht Club, so Rick goes way back with Ken and myself.
Who's Rick Patron?
Rick Patron came in after Rick Johnson. In the midst of all this recording that we started to do, Rick Johnson said, I can't live on this. I got to go get a real band job. And the truth be known, none of us could live on it. And if I had a real album here today, it's probably more than the whole band made together in the time period that we existed. So
just for the record then, who's the drummer on Smooth as Silk and Doctor of Philosophy?
Yeah, it's fantastic. On the CD.
Drummer on those is Rick Johnson.
Right.
That's
right.
Rick Johnson. Okay.
Yeah, it's you can really tell his drumming style on those two.
Now you're no longer on Peter May's Falcon label. You're on Candy Floss. How did that switch come about?
That was Dale and Peter Steinberg, I believe, were Candy Floss.
Right.
Dale Menton and Peter Steinberg.
And also the engineer, there was an engineering change from Marv to Steve Longman.
Steve Longman, that's
okay.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
Was that an important factor in the
sure.
transition?
He was, yeah,
sure.
He was.
In the musical transition? Was
oh,
that
yeah.
In...
Yeah, he encouraged our experimentation and trying things, you know. Mm-hmm. Who else will go along with somebody... bringing a gong in and starting the song out with a gong. So, you know, he didn't restrain us whatsoever, and he actually had contributions on what he thought would work well. And
so this 45, the band's third 45, comes out in 1968. What happens with this 45? Any airplay?
Yeah, it got airplay, and I'm not so sure about 68 because I'm pretty sure the album came out in 69.
I mean the 45.
Yeah, but I'm not so sure that the I'd have to go back in the records on that too to prove whether it was 69 or 68, but it was supposed to coincide with the album coming out.
Okay.
Yep.
But are WDGY and KDWB playing this?
Right. It's the usual. It's the same pattern as the first two 45s, except that maybe it didn't do quite as well in sales.
It wasn't as mainstream.
Right.
What would happen when the band played these two songs live?
I recall them going over really well. Yeah. We really enjoyed them.
Smooth as silk. Oh,
that was fun to play with Poling with his guitar going. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That was a good one to play. We couldn't do it today, of course, but
are you still wearing uniforms at this point?
If you want to call them that. We'd go to a costume shop, and whatever made the other guys laugh the most, that's what you bought.
Yep.
And that's what we were doing. And here, take a look at Tom right there, the outfit he's got on.
But you can see the evolution in uniforms there. We had green sweaters at one point, and then we would have suspenders with...
Yeah, that was blow to my soul.
We actually all wore dark boots with white spats.
Yeah, and this would be about the time frame of Smooth as Silk.
Yeah, that's we had.
I don't know. There's a mysterious looking aquarium plant in the center. I don't know how that got in there, but
whose idea was this aquarium photo?
I think that might have been
Alan again. No, Alan Forrest.
Oh, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, yep. We showed up at Alan. His photography studio, and he must have sensed something about us. And you guys would look good in a fishbowl, and you're kind of wild, so. We're part of the North American wildlife there.
So the band's evolving not only with the music, but with the stage presence.
Oh, it's a total metamorphosis.
Anything for a laugh. Take the boredom out of it and make it
fun. A total metamorphosis? A total change?
It totally went from the Motown dance music to we're going to go play what we want to play.
Yep.
And you'll either like it or not because...
That's what we're going to do.
Yeah.
And how did that go over with Central Booking and the fans?
Boy.
I'm going to say they didn't have a whole lot of involvement. We were probably still riding on the reputation of Mickey's Monkey, but...
And still playing those songs.
Yeah, but the audience had progressed and... Well, I wouldn't say we were still playing Mickey's Monkey at the same time we were playing Smooth as Silk. We had progressed live, too, so... The audience had changed, too. It went from a dance situation to where they were actually going to listen to what you're doing now.
To a concert.
Sort of, yeah. There's picture evidence of that where it's a big dance situation, but everybody's sitting out in the audience paying attention.
Did Smooth as Silk get any airplay out of the Twin Cities again, like Blow to My Soul did?
Yeah, it did.
What areas?
Well, I remember playing, you know, St. Cloud and... Nothing huge. We didn't go any far distances like to us. Lincoln, Nebraska was a long road out. But you know the small stations, Iowa,
Mason City, we put on there.
Clearwater. We played Iowa, North and South Dakota, Wisconsin.
Did you ever play the Roof Garden in Iowa?
Oh yeah, yep.
What was that place like?
Hard for me to remember. the one we all remember, we talked about audiences sitting down and listening. This was some strange deal. They must not have been allowed to dance at this. It was back to your roller rink now. And we set up and we start playing.
Which roller rink is this?
I can't recall. I know it was in Iowa. And what happened is the whole crowd would go in a circle. They'd walk all night. There was no dancing. Yeah, they'd walk in a circle and talk. And
clockwise.
Yeah. Was it clockwise?
No, counterclockwise, yeah.
Okay, yeah, I remember counter, so yeah. We can't remember where it was, but we do remember it was counterclockwise. Because you'd look out and you'd be playing the song, and there's the whole crowd in a circle, and they'd be walking counterclockwise.
You sure it was Iowa?
I remember
it could have been Mars with that story.
Wasika. I remember the 4-H building.
Was it Wasika? Okay.
They also had rubber tire shreddings they'd put on this cement floor.
Okay.
For what purpose?
I had no idea.
Strange. I think it was Mars.
But we'd run into a lot of things. Then,
yeah, that was a weird
one. Where were the places, the ballrooms owned by the old star, Hoot Gibson? Remember those?
The ones with
Hoot the Coot, we used to call them?
The disco balls?
Where you'd go, you'd get up on the stage and you're... They had a rules posted right there. You will play from.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
now,
yeah.
8 p.m. to 8:45. You'll get 15-minute break. You will be brought sodas.
Yep. We didn't do so well with rules. So,
Gibbons owned a number of ballrooms?
Yeah, he had the Playboy ballrooms in Denny Rochester and...
Danny can help us out.
Where was it? Glencoe, maybe? The Playmore Ballrooms, was it Rochester and Glencoe?
Might have been, it was Playland, but I can't remember where that was. That was Kimball? Yeah. Or...
I'm glad we're not the only ones, remember.
There's so many of those places.
Yeah, yeah.
Excelsior was Danceland.
Did you play Danceland?
Yeah.
How was that?
We had battles of the bands out there. We'd drive our truck right on this floor. It seemed like it was going to fall through.
Did you recall Reggie Callahan, the owner?
You know, I don't.
Ken usually handled the business end of things. So yeah. He dealt with the owners.
Handled, quotes.
Right.
So at some point prior to Smooth as Silk, the band has already been at work on a number of different recordings at Dove, correct?
That's a tough one. I would say it was simultaneous. Ken had a program whereby, okay, now we're going to learn how to record. We've had a little luck here, and we tried this commercial thing, and it was a great recording with the violins and Doug singing and everything. And, you know, maybe with good promotion, that probably had the best chance. But I think Ken steered us in the direction of we're going to have to... If we're going to do anything at all, we're going to have to learn to record. And that's where the experimentation came in, and his writing and Doug's writing.
Just experimentation.
Right. Yeah, that's what I recall. You know, a lot of these songs like Colorado Morning, I think that was long before Rod Eaton or whoever at Dove came up with the album idea. You know, we were just taking triangles and adding it with odd rhythms and...
Yeah.
You know, we just...
So there was no centralized, focused plan to record Trip Through Hell?
No, not at all. No.
You were strictly recording songs.
Which is fun to read with all these reviews today, because there's all these elaborate theories on what it's about and how it was done. We probably shouldn't let this out, because it builds as every year goes by. So
what I hear you saying is you're strictly working on songs one at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I mean, separate ideas.
Maybe multiple songs, but just trying to do something different than what we were doing when we played jobs and try and learn how to record and get different tunes, you know, get different sounds. And
this starts in 1968, correct?
Mm-hmm. It had
67
to. 67
it 67, started.
Yeah, late.
Because in 68, I got drafted into the Marines.
Right.
Oh.
And Doug
it's one
actually...
those days you don't forget.
Huh. He actually had to come home from the Marines to finish Trip Through Hell. And Rick had left the group at one point there, or at some point there, because there was no money to be had. And he had to make a living. You know, he had to pay rent and everything, so that's when Rick Patron came in.
Where did you find him? Was he playing in a different band?
Well, he was, I think the connection was through Doug Maynard and Metropolitan Soul and a couple guys Ken and I went to church with. He lived on the east side of St. Paul, and... basically, we knew of him, and it's funny because 40 years later, he tells me, you know, I really wasn't a drummer, per se. I was a guitarist, and he hangs around with Billy McLaughlin these days and still writes music and lives over in Osceola right by Ken, so...